From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Saturday, September 8th, 1906, at the Bronx Zoo. As told in a new book, it was a sunny and warm day at the New York Zoological Gardens, and director William Hornaday was eager to show off a new exhibit. In his time at the zoo, he had taken pleasure in bringing in animals from around the world to educate and entertain the public, but this time, it was different. The crowd moved through the primate house, past the monkeys, the lemurs, the chimpanzees, the orangutans, the baboons, until they reached the far steel cage, and in that cage, the crowd found Otabenga, a man, a short African man from Congo. His teeth had been filed to sharp points, and in that confused crowd, a woman cut the silence by asking, "Is that a man?" It was. For William Hornaday, who bore all the hallmarks of classic white supremacy, this was a chance to show the public what a savage looked like up close. Maybe even, some wondered, a missing link between species. And I know it's a vile thought. Throughout the 19th century, human beings had been caged and exhibited in various ways and places around the world. But this was 1906, New York City, 40 years after the Civil War. And the truth is, even while some who saw Otabenga were uncomfortable, this was not cause for immediate condemnation from the entire crowd. To be sure, the African-American community reacted strongly in those days, and the sensation sparked newspaper articles. And here are the words of the New York Times editorial board published later that week. Quote, "We do not quite understand all the emotion which others are expressing in the matter. It is absurd to make moan over the imagined humiliation and degradation that Benga is suffering. The pygmies are very low in the human scale, and the suggestion that Benga should be in a school instead of a cage ignores the high probability that school would be a place from which he could draw no advantage whatever." End quote. Otabenga's story has been told for decades, but for most of the time it was spun, filled with lies or euphemisms. The zoo director would later say that no one ever forced that man into a cage. The man responsible for bringing Otabenga to the United States would change his story countless times, as the book details, lying about the circumstances of the capture. But now, finally, journalist Pamela Newkirk has put the lies to bed in an exhaustively researched book called Spectacle: The Astonishing Life of Otabenga. And Newkirk traces the racism of those days even to modern America. She's a professor of journalism at New York University. She's in Rochester for two events this week. And first, she's my guest here on Connections. I want to first say thank you for doing this work. It is remarkable. It's great to have you here. How are you?
Thank you. So wonderful to be here.
When's the first time you remember hearing the story of Otabenga?
I heard the story, I think it was about 6 years ago, and when I initially heard the story, it was not one that I was particularly interested in leaning in to. I looked around to see what had been written. It appeared that he may have been complicit in his exhibition, but once I read the book by the grandson of the man who brought him here, that purported to be the story of friendship between his grandfather and Otabenga, I was intrigued. And I said, how does one corroborate friendship between, an African explorer and his subject? So I began my exploration in the archives, and that's where I found what truly did happen to Otabenga.
The grandson's book that you're talking about, I think, was published in 1992. So this is a modern book still spinning this story as friendship and complicity. And even the Wikipedia entrance today doesn't bear much mention of forced captivity or forced display in a steel cage. It quotes Hornaday as saying, he was free to roam the grounds.
Right, because that book, which became a New York Times notable book, inscribed that fiction into the hard drive of history. So that story circulated all over the world, and not only on Wikipedia, but in the Virginia Encyclopedia. All of these authoritative references cite that book, and almost nothing in the book is true.
Yeah, well, the book now, the book we're talking about today, Pamela's book, is called Spectacle. Everything in this book is true, and actually I appreciate not only the fact that you lay right out at the beginning, you are writing based on historical research, and where there is speculation, you note it directly in the
book. Exactly, because my book is primarily based on primary documents. There were voluminous records documenting what happened to Otubenga, sometimes on a daily basis, so I'm able to trace his footsteps from the Congo through Europe and across New York, and then finally when he ends up in the Monkey House, and after. So, and there are citations, which I fought to include because the story is so unbelievable that I wanted people to see that this is very well documented.
My guest is Pamela Newkirk, who is in Rochester for a couple of events today. An event tonight from 5 to 6:30 in the Hawkins Carlson Room of the Rush Reese Library titled Why Otubenga Matters, Race, Mythology, and the Persistence of Prejudice. Then tomorrow, from 10:30 to 12:30, also in the Hawkins Carlson Room of the Rush Reese Library, media coverage of the Black Lives Matter movement. And that's another passion and piece of work for Ms. Newkirk. We're going to be kind of tying these together as we go throughout the hour. But I do want to work through some of the history here of Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Otubenga. When my son's old enough, I'm going to have him read this book. NPR chose this as one of their books to read from 2015. They called it required reading. But why? Here's the question I ask, because some have said, well, we knew the sad story of history was that in much of the 19th century, some human beings were caged in various exhibitions, world fairs, etc., for all kinds of awful reasons, and that Otubenga was not the only one who was ever there. So why this book? Why now?
Because as atrocious as the idea of human zoos are, this was not a human zoo. This was a zoo for animals.
Yeah, the Bronx Zoo.
It was the Bronx Zoo, this nation's most famous zoo at that time and now. Perhaps, and it was presented as science. It was presented as something that, during the progressive era, at the dawn of the 20th century, that scientists signed off on. You know, scientists. One of the trustees at the Bronx Zoo, at the time, was one of the most eminent scientists in this country, Henry Fairfield Osborne, one of the co-founders of the zoo. He thought it was a good idea. Madison Grant Hornaday, who was the founding director of the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., again, an eminent man of science.
These weren't marginalized people with obviously racist views. They're mainstream leaders.
Mainstream. And so it matters because it's important that we see our heritage, right? That we're able to connect the dots from where we were 100 years ago to where we are, and the resonance of some of these ideas that were so deeply embedded and the bedrock of, you know, in science, history. I mean, if you looked at an encyclopedia in 1906, if you looked up African, he was described in a Webster's collection as midway between an orangutan and a human being with you know, ape-like qualities. So these were mainstream ideas. You know, there were those who spoke out against this, like the great anthropologist Franz Boas was one of the few to say that this is outrageous, that, you know, there's no difference, that many of these differences that we see are due to history or due to social conditions. But the prevailing view by the most noted academics from the leading institutions, Princeton, Harvard, Yale. This is what their view of African life was at that time. So it should be no surprise that we continue to see these ideas, you know, come alive in on our streets, in our schools.
You see the seeds of what happened then manifest today.
Exactly. Why wouldn't they? And I think, you know, one of the things that that I find particularly troubling is that it's scientists, so-called scholars, who perpetuated these ideas, who created these ideas, right? And then they were then perpetuated by the media. It became part of our popular culture. And yet these institutions are not correcting the record in a way that we can get beyond some of these ideas of, you know, this whole notion of racial hierarchies where some people are less intelligent, some people are more intelligent. All of these ideas that were considered science 100 years ago, 80 years ago, 70 years ago, they're not directly addressed today, and the dots are not connected between some of the attitudes that are pervasive in our culture and where they may stem from.
This is, let me read, as Pamela writes in the book, another line from that same New York Times editorial, because again, we're talking about the story of putting a human being in a cage in an actual zoo.
With an orangutan.
With an orangutan, holding a monkey on display in 1906 in New York City.
Yes.
But are there modern seeds? Well, let me just read this again. The New York Times wrote then in 1906, "The idea that men are all much alike, except as they have had or lacked opportunities for getting an education of books, is now far out of date." So the New York Times is saying that's baloney. That's in the same editorial in which they wrote, "Pygmies are very low in the human scale," and that school would be a place of torture for Benga. So that's the New York Times editorial board.
That's considered a modern way of thinking about education.
Now, but some would say, okay, but that's 100 years ago. That's far, far, far in the past. That doesn't really manifest except for in the extreme, extreme populations in today's modern culture. But just a few months ago, there was a strong backlash at the Supreme Court when Justice Scalia raised a question during a discussion about affirmative action. And he raised previous research that indicated that students who benefited from affirmative action, or students who received, you know, got into schools based on affirmative action, non-white students, would struggle in more rigorous institutions, that they couldn't really handle the rigor of the academics,
right,
and that it would be better to put them in less rigorous institutions.
Right, despite all of the evidence to the contrary, which is shown that most of, you know, standardized testing and all of the ways in which people are, you know, granted admission into institutions really have no bearing, don't have the kind of bearing on how well they will do once they graduate.
Now, but the defenders of Scalia said he was misunderstood. He wasn't talking about an entire race. He didn't say all African Americans who get into better schools will struggle. He was saying those who are awarded admission into these institutions based on affirmative action will struggle, and that they should be put in less rigorous institutions, not all, mm-hmm, and that this should not be viewed as a parallel to some of the thoughts from 100 years ago. What would you say to that, Pamela?
I mean, you know, you can't limit it to Scalia. You know, if you look anywhere, look at the mass incarceration of blacks. When you look at drug usage, it's pretty much the same across racial lines. Blacks and whites use drugs at pretty much the same rate. And yet you have tens of thousands of young blacks who are in jail, many for low-level drug infractions that very few white kids would go to jail for. And then their lives are just ruined. Look at schools. We don't have equal access to quality education. You have whole generations being just wiped out based on the opportunities they will never be afforded because they're not educated. So it's not one thing someone says. You know, Donald Trump a few weeks ago said that most white people who are murdered by blacks. Of course, it's not true, but it resonates. And why does it resonate? Because these ideas of blacks as less than, as savages, all of these ideas are, they're just deeply embedded in the national psyche. So, you know, it's a shorthand. You don't even have to say that blacks are less than. You don't have to say, you can just intimate it. And everyone knows what it means. It's like a dog whistle.
We're talking to Pamela Newkirk, the author of the book Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Ota Benga. She's also a professor of journalism at New York University in Rochester for a pair of events, one tonight, one tomorrow, at the Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. And I want to establish a little bit more about what we know about Otebenga, because the man who brought him here was sort of the serial fabulist and liar, and the story kept changing over the years on the circumstances of his introduction to Otebenga. Who was he? But to the best of our knowledge, what do we know about how Otebenga came here?
Well, Samuel Verner he was assigned or hired by organizers of the St. Louis World's Fair of 1904 to bring back so-called pygmies, the diminutive people of the Central African forest, to bring them back to St. Louis to exhibit as samples of what were considered the lowest, you know, they were on the lowest point of civilization. At the lowest point of civilization. So Otebenga was one of several young men who were brought back to the United States. And as I said, Samuel Verner went there heavily armed. He stopped in London on his way to the Congo and shipped just like boxes and boxes of ammunition and all manner of military gear to execute his mission. So he went, I mean, he meant business. And Otebenga, you know, by all of the letters that he sent back indicated that he was willing to do whatever it took to bring back these so-called pygmies. In later articles, he admitted that he had intended to bring more people, but some got away. Some ran. So it's clear that these people were being brought by force. And on the fairgrounds, they were treated really poorly. They were like half naked on the fairgrounds.
The fairgrounds where, by the way?
At St. Louis.
1904.
1904, the St. Louis World's Fair. They were made to dance and entertain people. They were in the frigid temperatures. They weren't given coats or blankets. Anyway, so that was Otebenga's first experience in the United States. He was taken back, and then he was brought back to the United States, where he ended up in the Monkey House in 1906.
All right, so he ends up in Hornaday, again, who deserves just, I think, as much of our opprobrium as as Verner, you know, because he not only brings in Otebenga to display in a cage, but then had the audacity to say, well, he's free to roam the grounds. You know, he's not really against his will. This is probably better for him.
And even more than that, if he thought it was science, why did he litter the cage with bones cannibalism,
That was
right?
a detail that shocked me. So on that first day, that I think it was September 8th, 1906, that day, he had put bones in the cage.
Well, by the second day.
By the second day, he put bones in the cage to imply that this is a savage, he would be a cannibal.
Exactly. Oh. As if he had eaten something in that cage and the bones were left.
So the public that got in that first day, that Saturday, you know, they didn't know really what to expect. There were some who audibly indicated they were uncomfortable with what they were seeing. But take us through then the ensuing day. So the Bronx Zoo has a human in a monkey cage. In fact, a human with a monkey.
Right.
Holding a monkey at times.
Well, yeah. So by the second day, the New York Times article appears under the headline, Bushman Shares a Cage with Bronx Park Apes. This is on a Sunday. So thousands of people flock to the zoo to see Otebenga.
But it wasn't under the headline, Outrage at Bronx Zoo.
Oh, no. Bushman shares a cage with Bronx Park
Apes.
Like,
more like a curiosity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was a major draw, and Hornaday, knowing that there would be a large crowd, it was also unseasonably warm weather, he littered the cage with bones. He then places Otebenga in a larger cage, and he puts an orangutan in the cage with him.
Okay, and the public is showing up.
The public
they
is loving
see
this.
It. They want to see this.
Tens of thousands. On one Sunday alone, 40,000 people went to the zoo to see Otebenga. By the end of 20 days, 250,000 people went to the zoo, double the number from previous years to see Otebenga.
Now, despite this, though, there was at least some backlash that was growing, and the University of Rochester, and we get at least a little bit of a tip of the cap here. This was a moment of pride for me, and because, you know, you're reading this going, where's the outrage? And where's the white outrage? Where are the white people who are going to stand up and say, what is happening here? Well, there was. some of that, not a whole lot of that.
Well, no, well, the first person who raised objections was Reverend Robert Stuart MacArthur, who was a graduate of the University of Rochester Divinity School.
1867, and an influential white pastor in New York, right?
Probably the nation's most influential pastor, who was an advisor to presidents and at one point had been offered an ambassadorship. But he was also a beloved figure in New York City. He had a really progressive ministry. The Colgate family were among the people who attended his church. He ministered to, upper middle class white New Yorkers, but he also ministered to African Americans who lived in the nearby Tenderloin district. He had missions around the world. He really, really did the work of the church to help people who were in need. And so when he saw Otabango on that first day in the cage, he was outraged, and he made his outrage known to the New York Times. And it was also MacArthur who immediately went back to black ministers at the nearby churches, called for an emergency meeting, and got them going. And so he really is one of the major saviors of Otabanga.
Yeah, he's a hero in the book, one of them.
Yeah.
But that didn't shut it down right away.
Oh, not at all.
Wasn't enough.
So the ministers, they went to meet with the mayor, Mayor McClellan, Princeton University grad, who's also the son of the famous Civil War general by the same name, McClellan. Anyway, they went to City Hall to meet with him. He refused to meet with them. He refused to intervene. Then they went to meet with Zoological Society board members. Anyway, they refused to stop it. In fact, Hornaday said he didn't even understand. Otabanga has the best room in the Monkey House. And then he insisted.
I don't mean to laugh. I mean,
it's outrageous.
I laugh at the sheer shock of hearing.
No, it's shocking.
The best room in the Monkey House.
Yeah, the best room. Right. That was his
defense.
And
they let him out in the afternoon. Like, people kind of followed him around the grounds. Right?
Exactly. With a keeper, though.
Sure, yeah, right.
Right. Right. So
how could he complain?
Right.
Yeah.
Why would anyone complain? And so this went on, and the crowds, got bigger and bigger, and because the protests were mounting, and black ministers now around the country were beginning to voice outrage, and the newspaper articles continued to basically support it, with a few exceptions, and one was William Randolph Hearst's paper, The Journal, in New York, which called it a utter outrage, a disgusting spectacle, but they pretty much were a voice in the wilderness. And so this went on. It headlines across, not just across New York, but also across the country. The Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times. I mean, this was a major, major sensation. Headlines began appearing in Paris and London. This was a major sensation. It was a successful exhibit.
And there, I don't remember exactly how it was said, but I you can help me out with this, Pamela, but the impression from the book is, for anybody who wanted to have the comfortable notion that, well, it was the Union versus the Confederacy in the Civil War, and slavery happened in the South, and the North were sort of this pure, much more forward-thinking, much more progressive, this should shake a little bit of that. For people who think, well, racism was banished to the South, and hey,
right.
Northerners,
Right.
Good history.
Many people don't understand the complicity of the North, because while cotton and all of these goods were coming from the South, where was the product being manufactured? Where the stores, the businesses, the factories were in the North. And so New York in particular was very complicit in the slave trade, and we also in New York City had slavery. When the New York Historical Society did the exhibit on slavery in New York, people were shocked.
And I think if you were to ask people, because most people don't know the story of Otabenga.
Right.
I certainly didn't until your book.
Right.
So if you ask people, in 1906, there was a zoo in this country, an animal zoo, not a human zoo or anything
right.
like that, an animal zoo that put an African human being into a cage to show off what a savage on the low end of civilization would look like, I think most people would say, well, that was somewhere in the South.
Right.
New York City.
Right. Even newspapers in the South mocked the North when they learned of this story.
That's what it was in the book that brought that theme to mind. Southern newspapers were mocking the North for saying, mocking New York City, saying, this is your zoo?
Exactly.
You've got a man in a cage next to monkeys?
Precisely.
We're talking to Pamela Newkirk, and the book is Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Otabenga, who was the man who was put in that cage in 1906. Had he not become a little bit obstreperous, as just about anybody would, maybe Hornaday would have held on longer, but he started looking for a way out, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he would fight, bite, scratch, kick, do everything he could when they tried to put him back in the cage. And Hornaday, in response, said he was an unruly savage.
How dare he?
That,
yeah, right.
You know, Werner, come get this unruly savage.
Because Werner had left. Werner, by the way, the guy who captures Otabenga, brings him here, and then leaves him at the Bronx Zoo. He's got debts and problem of his own.
Well, he was running from the sheriff.
Because he was fraudulent in so many other ways, so he was in trouble. He goes to another state, North Carolina?
Yes, he went south to try to straighten out his affairs.
Sure, and then Hornaday starts saying, come take this guy. You know, I mean, like, you brought him here, he's a problem, he's not being kind to our zookeepers, come take him. And what happened next?
So he was rescued, he was taken in by the Howard Cullet orphanage in Brooklyn's Weeksville section that was run by African Americans, the first orphanage in New York City for African Americans, because all institutions were segregated at that time. Segregated hospitals, nursing homes, schools. I mean, New York was every bit as segregated as in the South. And so anyway, so he spent some time there. He was sent to Lynchburg, Virginia. And the book kind of chronicles what's happening to him at every step of the way. But when he immediately went to Weeksville, he was treated as a welcome stranger. He was given his own room. He was embraced.
Unfortunately, he did not live a long life. He wanted to eventually get back to Congo.
Right.
He knew that would not be possible by the time he was in his young 30s, 32?
Not even. If you look at the pictures of Otabenga when he was in St. Louis, the picture on the cover of my book was taken in 1904. He looks like a kid.
He sure does.
And
he does.
Later in his life, he said he was about 12 or 13 when he was captured in the Congo, which looks about right. That's how old he looks in that picture.
Yeah, he was presented as 23 years old at the Bronx Zoo in 1906, but you're saying that was probably not right.
Oh, it almost certainly wasn't right. They said he was married with children. He was a child. Yeah. I mean, you look at Otabenga, he was definitely a child.
And so, before we get
to... So he was probably about 23.
Yeah.
When 23 to 25 when he died.
And you know, just... He decided that, well, tell us a little bit how he died, and then we'll kind of start working back.
So he spent the last 6 years of his life in Lynchburg, Virginia. He was embraced by the African-American community there. He wanted to go home, basically. He first went to school there. He did a number of odd jobs. He worked in the tobacco fields. He did, you know, errands for local people. And he was beloved, but he wanted to go home. I mean, here's a kid who was taken from his home, from his culture, from his family, his friends, the life he knew. No matter how embraced he would be in Lynchburg, he would never be totally integrated into American culture, American society. He had lived in the Congo on his wits as a hunter. He and his people worshipped nature. They did dances celebrating nature as their ancestors had for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. So he lived a totally different life than he would later live in the United States, and like I said, also separated from his people.
And so he died in 1916,
which would be 10 years after the Bronx Zoo exhibit.
the sad story of Otubenga. And I imagine now you must be hearing from schools, school teachers. Is this book being presented to students? I'm assuming that this eventually will be kind of standard reading at some level.
Oh, that's nice of you to say. Well, mostly universities, colleges. Not schools. Not like high schools and lower grades. Not so far.
Well, the book is out now. One of NPR's books of 2015 on their list of books, which is, I know, a great honor. But in so many ways, Pamela's work, I think, is beyond just a book on a book list. I think this book will last for a long time. And just want to remind you that she's got a couple of events as part of the lecture series organized by the Frederick Douglass Institute for African and African-American Studies at the University of Rochester. And those events are today, later today, a lecture at 5 o'clock at Rush Reese Library. It's the Hawkins Carlson Room, Why Otubenga Matters, Race, Mythology, and the Persistence of Prejudice. Then tomorrow, 10:30 to 12:30, also at the Hawkins Carlson's Room of the Rush Reese Library, the presentation there on media coverage of the Black Lives Matter movement. Let's talk about that after this very short break with author and journalism professor Pamela Newkirk, next on Connections. And coming up tomorrow on Connections in the first hour, timely. We're talking about the future of libraries, funding for libraries in question on many levels, what is the place of the modern library, and what is the future of something like Rush Reese Library, or maybe the library that you grew up going to. We're going to talk about that tomorrow. Then in our second hour, we've got a lot to talk about, not the least of which one of our good friends of the program, John Kovach, will be in, talking about recent deaths in music, legacies of great musicians, always fun conversation there, and we'll have that in our second hour. So that's all coming up on Friday.
Picture this, you're at the big game, your team is losing, it feels like nothing's going your way.
And then in this great dramatic parabola towards you in the stands comes this balled up t-shirt, and you've got a box out grandma on your right and the 11-year-old kid on your left, and you snag it.
The joy of the t-shirt cannon and other mysteries of sports and brains later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A note from Lisa just says, haunting and so sad. Thanks for this interview, Evan. You're welcome, Lisa. Pamela Newkirk, the author of the book Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Otubenga. Astonishing is not hyperbole there. And one of the reasons this book was necessary in the year 2015, when it was published last year, is because for decades, the myth persisted that this man who was brought to this country as a spectacle to be shown off and to be exhibited, and then eventually ended up in a steel cage in a zoo. Well, the myth persisted that that was not true, that he was complicit, that he was a friend of the person who brought him here, that he enjoyed it, and that, Pamela, you were saying Otubenga dies in 1916, and the New York Times said what?
The New York Times, in an article which had a really insensitive headline, Otubenga, Tide of America. Otubenga killed himself, which I'm leaving out, so it was pretty tragic. Otubenga, Tide of America. No, Otubenga, Pygmy, Tide of America. In that article, it basically said that he had never been exhibited at the zoo, that it was urban legend. So the whole history of this episode had been entirely rewritten, and the people who exploited him had the last word on what actually had happened.
And that's no longer true, and that's thanks to Pamela's work here. And some of the work that you do now is at least educating the public on your thoughts on sort of modern media coverage. And one of the questions people often have, you know, right or wrong, you've heard this, is why Black Lives Matter? Why not all lives matter? You know, Blue Lives Matter. Why does it have to be Black Lives Matter?
Right.
And so let's start there.
Yeah, so that's really what my talk is about tonight. You know, Black Lives Matter, you know, as I will say tonight, it's more than an assertion. It's a prayer. It echoes across the centuries. People from Africa who have been, as Otubenga's people were in the Congo, it's one of the most ruthless regimes ever, Leopold's Congo. You know, millions of Congolese murdered, maimed, enslaved to enrich the Belgian Congo, and Leopold himself, and the world watched. So did Black Lives Matter then? So Black Lives Matter is a question, it's a call, it's a prayer. It's not saying that other lives don't matter. It's saying the evidence is suggesting that our lives don't matter. But we want our lives to matter because they do matter. They do matter, but it's a challenge to the country to make real that Black lives matter. Not just say all lives matter. I mean, that's an easy thing to say. But to show that all lives matter, which would look like equality. It would look like a criminal justice system that was fair, that showed that all lives matter. It would look like schools that have equal resources and are doing the job of educating kids in a fair and equitable way. So what it looks like when something matters should be evident. It should be evident. We should not see social indicators that show that the gap, the economic gap, the health gap, all of the disparities that exist between Black and white lives. Does it matter? So Black Lives Matter is a challenge to what is seen and what is felt, as indifference. This is processed as people don't care. So it appears Black lives don't matter. Black people think their lives matter. People who have children and see their children as the most precious creations on the planet, they believe their lives matter. So Black Lives Matter is a challenge for everyone to recognize the humanity of Black life, which has been, over centuries, dehumanized, diminished, devalued.
All right, let me grab a phone call. This is Gary, who wants to weigh in as well. Go ahead, Gary.
Hi, Evan, and thanks for having this guest on. And I first heard of this book and saw a book review on C-SPAN Books. And so I'm glad you're here in Rochester.
Thank you.
I don't know if anybody has brought this up or if your conversations you can ask. But when we talk about Black people being depicted as animals, sadly, there's a carousel, a merry-go-round located in one of our county parks, which is actually in the city. And around the top of the merry-go-round are panels depicting various animals, with one exception. And then that one exception shows two Black children, and it shows them with their eyes popping out and at the sight of a rooster.
Mm-hmm.
And still, after many months of struggle with a lot of our, we still haven't been able to get this art covered up or taken down. And it was originally designed at about the same time period as you're talking about. So, unfortunately, when Evan, you mentioned earlier about where was the outrage, I hate to say it, but almost 100 years later, we see the same thing here, right here in Rochester. And I'm just wondering if your guest has heard about this or, and again, just maybe just comment on that relation, like how far we have or have not come.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you. I had not heard of that specific depiction, but those depictions of Blacks as animals, as savages, and particularly as monkeys, apes. If you Google Obama and monkeys, it's shocking, how many images crop up. So this is not uncommon, 100 years after Oda Benga, and that's why I'm saying these ideas are so deeply embedded in our ideas of, human beings. I think a lot of people really do believe that there is a racial hierarchy and that Blacks are at the bottom of it. I think that is still a prevailing idea that began, not just a century ago, many centuries ago, but was still prevalent at the dawn of the 20th century and well into the 20th century.
Here's an email that comes from Silas from the Frederick Douglass Institute at the University of Rochester, which
Hi,
is
Silas.
Sponsoring this. and Silas, a professor of French and Francophone Studies. among other things there. So Silas writes to us and says, "Beyond the scientific racism, otherwise known as Darwinism, I've always been stunned by the way Benga's body was trapped in the zoo. I cannot imagine the public humiliation and degradation he felt for being exhibited, the shame, the pain. I'm also reminded of the brutal mutilation of Emmett Till's body in the Jim Crow South, and closer to us by the degradation of Michael Brown's body in Ferguson. Brown's body was left on the street for hours after his death."
Precisely.
And so Silas writes, "Why is it that beyond the erasure of the black body, there's this obsession to degrade the dead body in lynchings, in the case of Brown, in the case of Emmett Till?"
I think it goes back to this ideology that was so deeply embedded. I don't think you can get away with from the way in which these ideas were sanctioned by scholars, right? How these ideas are now sanctioned by those who have the authority to say, and they said, like, definitively, that Africans were savages. They were less than human. And I think it's very difficult to accord someone humanity when it's being said by those who should know that these people are not really fully human. And I think it is the gateway to the kind of mutilation of black bodies that we've seen over time. It's the way everything from colonialism to slavery to what we see now, you know, tens of thousands of young black boys and men caged, many for offenses that no white person would serve jail sentences for. And, you know, a parallel that I see between Oda Benga, you know, Oda Benga could be viewed as a metaphor for black lives today. He was hunted, stalked, captured, caged, just as many young blacks are today. I mean, we've seen on videotape a former Coast Guard being shot in his back while he fled, a man who was said to be selling loose cigarettes caught in a chokehold, crying out 12 times, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe," until he was killed on videotape. We've seen over and over this utter disregard for black life and cases which go without prosecution oftentimes, or with the people responsible for taking these lives acquitted. And so I think, you know, we cannot get away from the science, because I think that is where many of these ideas were given the kind of sanction that allows people to hold these pernicious views of black life.
Alan writes an email and says, essentially, and I can't read the whole email, let me try to sum up Alan's point of view. He's saying he finds it disingenuous that 100 years after Oda Benga, 100 plus years, that we're still the same. He said that he had never heard of Oda Benga, but he is appalled by the story, appalled by what happened, but that could never happen today. You could never see any human being put in an animal cage in a zoo and exhibited that way. And that we're not perfect, but he's been made to feel guilt as a white man in 2016.
Why would he feel guilty? Because I think every day...
He's saying it's unfair to him to make him feel any sort of guilt, because he would never have stood for that.
But why would he
different.
Feel guilty unless he had something to do with putting Oda Benga in a cage? I mean, that's problematic already, that there's no invitation to guilt. Like, no one is asking anyone to feel guilty, unless maybe if Samuel Verner was your father, you probably wouldn't be so proud of what your father did. But as you indicated earlier on, you know, one of the heroes of this book is Reverend Robert Stuart MacArthur, who's white. So no one has a monopoly on humanity. There are people who behave humanely, and they see other people as full human beings, and they behave accordingly. The problem is that not everyone views black people as fully human, which helps explain what we continue to see. You know, you can look at trigger studies. Trigger studies consistently show that when someone is shown with a pen or a weapon, if it's a black person, people are far more likely to shoot, and shoot really quickly. these ideas are embedded, deeply embedded in the psyche. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about an ideology that is rooted in science, that's rooted in so-called scholarship, and that continues to kind of percolate, to echo in the culture in different forms. So you don't have to see a young African in a zoo today, but you can look at the tens of thousands of young African-American men in cages, in prisons, many for low-level drug infractions, that even now in Congress, many Republicans and Democrats are beginning to recognize as a social justice issue, as a issue concerning all of our humanity. You know, we're complicit when we see injustice and we walk away. Reverend Robert Stuart MacArthur saw something that other people saw, and they reveled in it. He spoke out. He used his voice, his indignation, his eloquence to save this young man. And, you know, one of the takeaways from this story is not to feel guilty, but to use your eloquence, your position, your status when you see injustice. I mean, to me, that would be what I would look at, not guilt, because guilt is a kind of a useless reaction to anything. You know, every day we have an opportunity to do something to make the world a better place.
There are examples throughout history where someone in more of a position of power has helped, whether it was the white pastor
Precisely. Who
we're talking about in this case. I think if I'm remembering correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in your book you mention when King Ferdinand of Belgium, King Leopold
mm-hmm.
of Belgium was engaging in slaughter.
Genocide. Yeah.
But the world was being told, no, he's a friendly king. He's doing great things for them. Wasn't there someone who traveled there and sort of witnessed it and cataloged and tried to speak up?
A number of people, and Mark Twain was one of the biggest critics of Leopold's reign. And so, I mean, this is not purely a racial issue, but we cannot get away from the implications of race in the dynamic, right? And in the resonance of some of these ideas today, it would not be honest for us to say that race has no significance in our society. That would be disingenuous.
March 18th. Will mark 8 years since President Obama and then candidate Obama gave his race speech in Philadelphia, a speech on race, healing, the way forward, our history in Philadelphia. And it came at a time, of course, when he was in the middle of a campaign, a tightly contested campaign. He was talking and dealing with his associations with Reverend Wright, and he was being challenged to talk about race. And he did in what many call perhaps the finest speech he ever gave. And so coming up on March 18th on this program, we're going to devote both hours to looking back at his speech. We're going to go over it. We're going to take a look at what has changed and what hasn't changed specifically from that. I don't have the text in front of me, nor does Pamela, but I'm curious to know, in his presidency, you can't give it sort of a national grade on how we're doing here, but I think a lot of people are surprised that 8 years later we still feel so divided. How do you feel?
And maybe even more so. I think there was a tremendous backlash to President Obama that has unfortunately driven us further apart than perhaps we were before. I think it highlighted the racial issues that we have, and maybe it's that it made people fear what would happen with a more level playing field. Today, Charles Blow in the New York Times described the election that we're now in, the presidential election, as like watching a national nervous breakdown. And he was responding to an article on the growing number of suicides among whites.
Middle class whites,
yeah, right, yeah. And higher incidence of drug use. And I think that, you know, this country has gone through a really tough economic transition over the past 20 years or so that I think is beginning to really take root in white America in ways that it may not have before. I mean, I think the kind of poverty, the kind of hopelessness, the kind of joblessness that many people are experiencing now, there's nothing new to African Americans, to Latinos, to other populations. But I think for white America, it's been pretty dispiriting. So when you add to that this growing population of people of color in all of these projections that, you know, this will be a minority-majority country, you know, by 2050, I think that does engender fear, fear of the unknown, fear of losing your place in a society in which you were undoubtedly, you know, a central player, that you may need to share that stage with other people. But I'm not a psychiatrist, neither is Charles Blow, but I'm speculating that that could be the reason for this growing unrest, growing unease in this country. And it's not just with whites. I think many people are feeling displaced and, you know.
Well, we've got about 30 seconds left, so let me just offer maybe a note of optimism here. And this, again, I'm psychoanalyzing as poorly as anybody else here. But for everybody who said, well, it's our first black president, you know, post-racial America, which is, of course, sort of a silly notion. But their hopes that things would sort of heal and get instantly better. Maybe it took a president, a non-white president, for a lot of what was under the surface to come right to the surface, and now it's more confrontable, and then you can move forward. Maybe that had to happen. So that's my optimistic view of it. Again, I'm probably the worst person to psychoanalyze, but Pamela Newkirk, the book is called Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Oda Benga. It's a remarkable piece of work. Thank you for being here. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
And you can see her, two different opportunities to see Pamela tonight, 5:00. The Hawkins Carlson Room of the Rush Reese Library, Why Ota Benga Matters, Race, Mythology, and the Persistence of Prejudice. Then tomorrow at 10:30 a.m., also at the Rush Reese Library, media coverage of the Black Lives Matter movement, two opportunities to do that. So our thanks to her, our thanks to Kate Cowie Haskell, our intern today, and Val Abanka, the engineer of the program, Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for listening to Member Supported Public Radio.